From California to New Jersey, Arizona to Illinois, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a number of new polls are out showing Donald Trump with a small but consistent lead over President Joe Biden in most key battleground states. Keith Naughton from Silent Majority Strategies is here with analysis. Primary election results were as expected in West Virginia, but there were some surprising results in Maryland. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Biden administration has suspended grant funding for the nonprofit at the center of the Wuhan lab leak controversy. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine report. And some states are distorting the free market by using tax policy to pick winners and losers. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Former President Donald Trump continues to lead President Joe Biden in all but one of the key battleground states. But the race is razor close. Here to parse through the numbers is Keith Naughton. He is principal at Silent Majority Strategies and a frequent contributor to The Hill and The American Spectator. Keith, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Keith, the presidential race appears to be somewhat consistent at this point. Some polling out this past week from the New York Times Siena poll. Want to tell us what the numbers are looking like for the Trump-Biden race in the battleground states?
Well, they polled in six battleground states, including Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. And they found Trump leading in five out of six. He was behind by 1 point in Michigan, and that was with likely voters. With all registered voters, he was ahead in all states. Now, the Great Lakes states were very close, but one of the things that's got to be bothering the Biden people is he is way behind in Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, and that's been repeated in other polls, including the Bloomberg Morning Consult polls, not as quite a big spread, but Biden's been consistently behind by Georgia by a significant margin. This is the largest margin he's been behind in Nevada. I mean, I think they're at a point where Biden's going to have to write off Georgia. And, you know, he's in a lot of trouble in Nevada and Arizona. So he might just be fighting it out in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, and that's it. And they have no hope in North Carolina. I don't see anybody even looking at that any longer. And that was the closest state that Trump won in 2020.
Adding up the electoral votes in all those states, if Trump were to win those states and carry all the states he carried in 2020, pretty much puts him over the top, doesn't it?
Well, he needs to win one of the Great Lakes states. So he needs to win Pennsylvania, Michigan, or Wisconsin if he carries Georgia, Arizona, Nevada. Nevada's kind of a hitchhiker on everything. They don't really, if you win Arizona, Georgia, plus Wisconsin, that puts you over the top. I mean, there's one scenario where if Trump can win that one congressional district in Nebraska, along with Nevada, he could have a tie, and then we'd go to the House of Representatives, where it's one vote, one state. So that would be, you know, Wyoming gets one vote, California gets one vote. That's pretty far-fetched, but it is possible.
Well, it has happened before in American history, and that's a whole story for another day. It's a very fascinating one, actually. But so the polling is showing former President Trump ahead in most of the battleground states, as you pointed out, all but one among likely voters. It's your thought, looking over this, and of course you pore through many, many different polls here, Keith, that all of this is underestimating the former president's support. Want to talk a bit about that?
Well, it could be. As an incumbent president, you can expect to fall back a little bit. I mean, all the undecided people know you. So if you're losing these undecideds and you're under 50%, that's a problem. Now, of course, everyone knows who Trump is. So that's a little bit canceled out. But one of the issues that Biden is facing is a couple of key constituencies, and this is found in the New York Times poll, but it's been in several other polls. Younger voters, Black voters, and Hispanic voters are really the ones who are leaving this Biden-Democratic coalition. Now, they're not so much moving towards Trump, although Trump is picking up a decent chunk of additional Black voters and Hispanic voters, but some of them are going to the third party vote. Some of them are kind of sitting on the fence. And so Biden's got to claw all those people back just to get closer to Trump. And he's going to have his hands full doing that. So Trump is in very good shape on the polling side if he can just hang on to what he's got and pick up a few of the undecideds.
Looking at the polling on issues that are of concern to the American voter as we head into the summer months here, Keith, the issues that the president seems to like to talk about, particularly threats to democracy, climate change, the whole issue of so-called reproductive rights, they don't really poll very high on the list of concerns, do they?
No, they don't. They tend to be much lower issues. They're definitely eclipsed by inflation and immigration. The reason why Biden and the Democrats are talking about those are they're the only ones their coalition agrees on. When he starts talking about immigration and inflation, or if he were, the solutions to those problems are opposed by people in his coalition. Like if you take inflation, you've got spending going through the roof, you've got an avalanche of regulation, and you have really no increase in taxes. And like, not that I'm for increasing taxes, but if you did increase taxes, you would pull back some of the spending, would sort of pull out of the economy and reduce that inflationary effect. So when you put those three things together, you've got serious inflation. Well, he can't cut back on government spending because his coalition demands that. He can't cut back on regulation because, you know, Elizabeth Warren would go screaming to the press every 5 seconds. So he's stuck complaining about greedflation and all this fake nonsense just as a PR stunt and hoping that it will somehow go down. So he's really got no solution on inflation. Same thing with immigration. These are the top two issue concerns for people. Plus, in the YouGov polling, his approval on the number one and number two issues, these top issues, is lower than his overall approval rating. So he's got a serious foundational problem on his approve-disapprove.
We also have a couple of wild cards out there at the moment. We have former President Trump in the midst of this trial in New York. We'll have to await the outcome of that. But talk for a minute or so here, Keith, about the impact of the war between Israel and Hamas. Is this also tearing at President Biden's coalition?
I think it definitely splits things up for him. But his real problem is he won't take a stand. And the fact of the matter is, most voters, including Democrats, are opposed to Hamas. They're generally supportive of Israel. They don't like all the violence, but, you know, when you ask Americans, typically they're all for peace and ceasefires and so forth. So I don't really put a lot of credence into that. But Biden doesn't want to stand up because there's this very loud, tiny minority is causing him so much angst among sort of elitist media and so forth, and it's really hurting him.
Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies, keeping an eye on all the polling that is taking place in the presidential race. You can read Keith's work at the American Spectator and in The Hill. Keith, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, thank you.
Primaries continue state by state across the country, and Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth has been keeping a very close eye on all those results. Scott, good to have you back with us.
Always great to be with you, Lohman.
Let's start out in Maryland. Maryland normally isn't a state we talk a lot about here, Scott, because it's usually one-sided. But this year, looks like it could be quite competitive. They had their primary this past Tuesday. Surprising results. What happened?
Last year, you might recall that Senator Ben Cardin announced that he would retire at the end of 2024. And so you had two Democrats facing off in a hotly contested race for the Democratic nomination. The first candidate is current U.S. Congressman David Trone, who is known as the owner of Total Wine, a billionaire, very, very wealthy, and he self-funded his race. And then you had Prince George County executive, a woman named Angela Alsel Brooks. And it ended up being a pretty tight race, but Trone lost. And he spent over $60 million of his own money to come up short. Angela Alsel Brooks will be the nominee facing former Republican Governor Larry Hogan. And a lot of Republicans in the Washington establishment are really, really excited about this because they think that it makes Maryland a state that's in play to help flip the majority and strengthen those Republican senators. You know, the thing about Larry Hogan, he's somebody who defeated cancer. He was a fairly popular governor, but he's also viewed as somebody that's sort of a never-Trumper and is pro-choice Republican. So when you think about the national enthusiasm for somebody like him running against really a candidate that, in my view, came out of nowhere to defeat David Trone, Angela Alsel Brooks, it's going to be one to watch in November. I think it's going to receive a lot of attention from the national committees in terms of spending, and it is a pickup opportunity no matter how you feel about Hogan or Alsel Brooks. Then when you think about what happened because Trone was running for the Senate, he vacated sort of a swing district in Maryland. The farthest west in the state is the 6th Congressional District of Maryland, and there we have a solid Republican named Neil Peart that just came up short in 2022 in winning a race. I think he lost by just a couple thousand votes, and Neil is going to be the Republican nominee. We think that that's a pickup opportunity, and that'll be a fun one for November. Also on Tuesday night, we had competitive races in West Virginia. The biggest one was governor's race, where Club for Growth PAC endorsed Attorney General Patrick Morrissey and invested over $10 million in that race. And so Morrissey fended off a political chosen one with Mor Capito, the son of a current U.S. senator, the grandson of a former governor. And Morrissey ended up winning by over 6%, over 10,000 votes. That was a great win for conservatives. Patrick Morrissey will replace Jim Justice as the next governor of West Virginia. So then you do slide over to the Senate race. President Donald Trump early on endorsed current governor Jim Justice for the United States Senate seat being vacated by Joe Manchin. And there was a conservative option there. Alex Mooney is a current U.S. congressman. And unfortunately, he came up way short in that race because it shows the strength of, number one, Justice being a former governor. Number two, I think the Trump endorsement does matter a lot in Republican primaries.
So we have those races decided in Maryland and West Virginia, certainly West Virginia in the U.S. Senate going into the Republican column this fall, maybe even Maryland, which would be a very big shakeup in the power structure. Speaking of power structures, the presidential race, as we talked about on this program a little while ago, very close. Now, surprising decision this past week by the Biden campaign to do debates, but is it really a level playing field here, Scott?
This week, it was announced by a couple of TV stations. First of all, it wasn't the Presidential Commission on Debates that typically announces these debates. Instead, you had CNN issue a press release, and it said that Joe Biden and Donald Trump have agreed to debate on CNN on June 27th. And this is unique because the Biden administration has really been pushing for an earlier debate to help impact early voting. They put out a sort of a nonsensical statement that said, well, there's a lot of people in October and September that have early voted and they don't get to see the candidates in person. So let's have a debate that's much, much earlier on June 27th. Well, President Trump's not going to back down from, I think, any invitation to take on Joe Biden head-to-head in a debate. So they agreed upon that, despite the fact that I think for the first time in history, we have a presidential debate without an audience. And Dana Bash and Jake Tapper are going to be the moderators for CNN in this first debate. And unfortunately, the American people will not be able to witness it in person. Of course, it'll be streamed online. Of course, it'll be broadcast through television, and everybody will be able to watch, but you won't see those lifetime reactions that you do typically get to witness that have been such a big part about presidential debates. Think about Ronald Reagan when he said, "There you go again." Think about when George H.W. Bush said, "Read my lips." Think about when there's the reaction of somebody looking at their watch. There's a lot of things that play into a debate, and I don't think that debate performance really impacts a whole lot of voters unless there's something drastic that happens during the debate. I think a lot of people go into it. They want to see their guy perform well. They're excited. They use it as an opportunity to spend conversation with their friends and family. But ultimately, the viewership of a presidential debate, especially one being broadcast on CNN, will be a lot lower than what the turnout is, right? So it will be the game of perception, how the media portrays body language. You always have reports on those sorts of things. And then the second debate that was agreed upon, I think, is going to be September 10th on ABC News. That's also going to be a lot earlier than normally we've seen. In past history, you usually see one in late September, one in mid-October, and maybe one in late October. My hope is that they can find a resolution to do a third debate later on, because I think a lot of people need to see the performance of both these candidates in the weeks leading up to the election, not just the months leading up.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Clubforgrowth.org. First of all, you can sign up as a member for free, join over 550,000 other Americans, and you can also view our policies on economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. You can also follow us on X at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The nonprofit at the center of the controversy over a possible leak at the Wuhan lab that ignited the COVID-19 pandemic has had its grant funding suspended by the Biden administration. We turn to Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine for details.
This week, the Biden administration has suspended federal funding to the nonprofit whose work is at the center of a lot of the lab leak theories about the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, a nonprofit that was doing a bunch of work at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And so this decision from the Biden administration seems like a telling one as we continue 4 years on to try to understand the origins of that pandemic. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Christian Britschke. He's a colleague of mine at Reason and a reporter for Reason. And he's got the scoop here, got the information about Eco Health Alliance. Christian, thanks for taking some time and joining us here on the show to explain all this.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this nonprofit I just mentioned, Eco Health Alliance. They've been cut off by the Department of Health and Human Services.
Yeah, so Eco Health Alliance is a New York-based nonprofit. For years now, they've been doing, they're colloquially referred to as virus hunters. And so their main work has basically been going out into the wild, collecting viruses from bats, other animals, and then bringing them back to the lab to analyze, basically trying to find which viruses might be primed to leap from animals into humans. This work has always been controversial for two reasons. One, you're going out into the wild and collecting a lot of novel viruses, then bringing them back to labs and population centers, right? So there's a risk there. And then it's also just gotten a lot of criticism for maybe it's actually kind of useless, right? In that, you know, there's thousands, millions of viruses circulating in the wild. The idea that you're going to find the one that is most primed to lead the humans to become a pandemic is a pretty speculative venture, but nevertheless, they've been receiving funding for decades to do this kind of work. And then more controversially, beginning in 2016 or so, they've started to do gain-of-function work at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is at the center of, you know, the controversy now.
We are all familiar with the Wuhan Institute of Virology now, unfortunately. Tell us about what the Biden administration has done this week. What did they announce this week?
Well, they have suspended several grants that EcoHealth had received, one of which was to do this kind of work at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And they've also started the process for debarment that would basically prevent EcoHealth from receiving, you know, any sort of government funding for a period of at least 3 years, but potentially longer.
Another important part of this story, and I should say, I mean, you've done a great job covering this. I know for our listeners out there, there's also going to be a forthcoming piece in the magazine that goes into this into more detail, but you can check out at reason.com this week. The headline on Christian's piece is Biden administration strips federal funding from nonprofit at the center of COVID lab leak controversy. This decision, Christian, as you spell out in the piece, kind of builds on like an inspector general report from a year ago. I mean, there's been kind of mounting evidence that EcoHealth was, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you know they were doing things incorrectly, or they were overstepping their bounds on some of the work they were doing in Wuhan.
Yes. So as I mentioned, in 2014, EcoHealth got a grant to do that kind of work that I described. Go get viruses out in the wild and then sequence them, model them in the lab. Beginning in around 2016, they started taking these viruses and tweaking them, basically combining them with other viruses to see if that would make them more likely to infect human cells and genetically engineered mice, and if they would become more transmissible and more pathogenic, basically more deadly as a result. And when they were starting to do this, the Obama administration had imposed a pause on funding gain-of-function research. And so it's quite likely that they were in violation of that pause. NIH, when they reported that they were doing this work, NIH flagged it and says, you have to explain to us why this isn't gain-of-function research, which they did allegedly to NIH's satisfaction. But NIH also imposed a condition on them, which said, basically, if these viruses that you're creating in the lab, if they do show greater viral growth, greater ability to infect humans and, or human cells and be transmissible in human cells, then you have to stop this work. EcoHealth, their viruses did prove to be more transmissible, more pathogenic. They didn't stop this work. And then they also delayed reporting some of their results about how their viruses were more virulent for several years. They were supposed to report some of these results in 2019 before the pandemic, and they didn't end up reporting those until 2021, well after the pandemic.
We're talking with Christian Britschke. He's a reporter for Reason Magazine, a colleague of mine, talking about some work that he's done looking into EcoHealth, this nonprofit that's very much at the center of many of the lab leak theories involving the Wuhan Institute and the origins of COVID-19. Christian, not a lot of time left here, but I mean, okay, the Biden administration cut off funding to EcoHealth this week. I look at that and I say, okay, great. You know, maybe better late than never, a little bit of accountability here. Is that the right takeaway, or is this part of a bigger thing?
Well, so the problem is the Biden administration is trying to be very narrow about this debarment. Basically, they're saying that we don't think EcoHealth, and Democrats investigating this in Congress have said the same thing, we don't think EcoHealth caused the pandemic or the pandemic was a result of a lab leak, but here EcoHealth failed their reporting requirements, weren't being transparent, and so therefore they're losing funding. The most serious issue with this is that it totally lets NIH, the organization, National Institutes of Health, the organization that was funding EcoHealth Alliance, off the hook for what was pretty obviously their own failures to provide oversight here. So, that's not something we're getting right now, but and I think that's where kind of debates about this are going to go as we move forward.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, EcoHealth, they deserve, I think, some accountability here, but that's a great point. Like, if we're not looking at the government agencies that failed in their, responsibility to provide that oversight, well, we're not getting the whole picture. We are unfortunately out of time. Christian, thanks for taking some time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is a big story. You could check out a big kind of sprawling story. You could check out Christian's piece this week at Reason.com that gets into some of this. He's got a forthcoming piece in, I think it'll be next month or the following month's issue of the magazine that will go into it in more detail as well. It's been 4 years since the pandemic hit, more than that, and we're still trying to get to the bottom of this question about where COVID-19 came from. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Tax policy is being used by some state governments to pick winners and losers rather than let market forces decide which products succeed. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this American Radio Journal commentary.
In day-to-day life, there are some taxes that everyone is familiar with. Personal income taxes, sales taxes, corporate income taxes, and property taxes generally get the most attention, in part because they collect the most revenue. But there are also countless targeted taxes on goods and services, from gasoline to alcohol, tobacco, vaping, cell phone plans, cable bills, and more. In the United States, the history of these taxes goes back to before the nation was founded. Printed documents, sugar, wine, silk are some of the many products on which American colonists paid taxes to the British. Famously, the tax on tea inspired the Boston Tea Party in the lead-up to the American Revolution. In 1791, a violent protest broke out over a federal tax on distilled spirits. The Whiskey Rebellion, as it came to be known, was eventually put down by none other than President George Washington. But this continuous history and long history of excise taxes has not stopped state governments across the country from imposing them, increasing them, and creating many new taxes over time. With each extra tax, the lessons from the 50 laboratories of democracy become even clearer. Excise taxes do not fit into the principles of sound tax policy generally. The best tax systems minimize the impact of government micromanagement on the economy. They take the approach that taxes should apply broadly and at a low rate. This way, the free market can expand. Businesses can create jobs, and Americans can earn a living and live their lives without taxes getting in the way. Excise taxes don't work with these principles generally. They exist because policymakers decide that certain goods or services should be subject to special taxes, while others should not. As we have documented for years in rich states, poor states, when taxes are raised in one state, there is a much larger incentive for consumers to cross state lines to purchase products at a lower tax rate. Just as Americans continue to vote with their feet and move from one state to another to avoid states with high income taxes. The differences in excise tax rates across state borders reduce the effects and revenue from these taxes. One study found that higher cigarette tax rates were strongly connected to higher rates of cross-border purchases. In New York, which has the highest cigarette tax rates in the country, more than half of the cigarettes consumed are either taxed in another state or not at all. The state loses an estimated $1.1 billion each year in revenues to these purchases in other states and in black market. To put it another way, the best thing to happen to New Jersey and Connecticut cigarette tax revenues has been sky-high tax rates in New York. When Maryland increased cigarette excise taxes in 2021, cross-border purchases increased by 29%. This trend was also observed with tax increases in Colorado and Oregon. All the while, these taxes often proved to be an unreliable source of revenue for the government. Many core functions of government require consistent funding year after year, which excise taxes cannot provide in many cases. Take one example from Colorado. The state uses online sports gambling taxes to fund water infrastructure projects. But in 2022, revenue from these taxes came up short, and the state suddenly did not have the funds to pay for these important projects. In response, the state increased the taxes. The dual conflicting purpose for excise taxes prevent them from being a reliable source of revenue for state governments. On one hand, the fiscal objective of these taxes, as with any tax, is to raise revenue for the state. The non-fiscal objective for excise taxes is to change public behavior related to the good or service being targeted. These two objectives are fundamentally working against each other. These taxes simply end up punishing consumers of the goods and services chosen by policymakers. The fundamental principles of sound taxation hold true. Taxes with low rates and broad, sensible bases provide the most reliable funding for core functions of government and are the least damaging to economic growth. On the other hand, discriminatory taxes, such as excise taxes, come up short by failing to provide reliable revenue for state governments while micromanaging decisions of individuals by picking winners and losers in the tax code. For more information on this and many other topics, visit alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WWNC AM in Asheville, North Carolina, along with KKEA AM and KHKA AM in Honolulu, Hawaii. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.